You are tuned into We Are Queer on WERU Community Radio Station 89.9 FM in Blue Hill, Maine. We Are Queer highlights the touching experiences for Maine's diverse LGBTQ+ community. From coming out stories to exploring new chapters, We Are Q is a voice to the queer people of Maine, building empathy and understanding in our greater community. I'm your host, Olivia Peruk, and I use she, her pronouns. This week, I'm interviewing Father Douglas Beck, who uses he, him pronouns and is the rector at St. Francis by the Sea Episcopal Church in Blue Hill. This episode's audio does have a few background noises. However, that does not take away from the incredible conversation with Father Douglas on his story of faith, queerness, and inspiring hope.
I began here in January of this year. So I could begin by sharing my own story of how it is that somebody who identifies as LGBTQ+ can end up as a rector of an Episcopal church in Blue Hill, Maine. I grew up in Pennsylvania in a farming community, and I am the first in my family to go on to higher education. My grandparents, all four of them, did not go past the eighth grade because at that point they were they ended their school education to return home to work on their family farms. So my second generation, two generations away from that, is a big part of my story. And also some of my other family background is that there are other clergy that are part of our extended family that go back a few generations. But in my immediate family, I'm one of the first to go on to higher ed. So leaving all of that, you know, I've had many coming out moments in my life. Some of them had to do with my sexual orientation. Some of that had to do with leaving home and not staying and meeting the family system that I grew up in. And some of that has to do with my education too. I was a curious child and I grew up not in an Episcopal church, but a different branch of Christianity that had very specific ways of being and requirements for its members. And being the curious individual that I am, I asked a lot of questions. Why is a complete question? And that frequently was a question that I asked. So I questioned my authority figures early on and learned that that probably wasn't the best way to explore my questions. So I became an avid reader. And one of the things that was in our household that I picked up and read frequently was a Bible. And I discovered that the faith that was expressed in that tradition and the faith as it was expressed in my childhood church were at odds, and that there was a deeper thread being traced than sort of the rule-oriented expressions that I grew up with.
Is there anything specifically as a kid that you felt pulled to when reading?
Well, I think I was drawn to all of the passages that talk about caring for others, accepting those that are not like you, expressions of love that go beyond what we see expressed in a purely human form. So there's a bit of the divinity that is left in us as created beings. And the church has an expression for that that was not part of my growing up tradition, but I learned about much later, called the Imago Dei and the image of God. So the image of God is reflected in God's creation. So creation around us, but us too, part of our creatureliness is a reflection of the creator. So I love that, and I feel very at home with that even my queerness is in some ways a reflection of the creator. And I think that opens up all sorts of possibilities for humanity because we are spiritual beings living a physical life. So there's another phrase that I'm thinking about from my childhood that really was a thread that held what I felt about my own identity in place when I was hearing something that was not affirming. And it was that God does not create junk. So there was sort of a bumper sticker slogan that I would put on a bumper sticker today and drive around. In fact, we should all do that. God does not create junk. The reminder that even in the days when we may feel like junk or we are treated as less than, it's a reminder to me that we are not that, and that is not the greater truth of our existence.
I'm just wondering how the connection to your faith, but your own kind of reckoning that if God, you know, creates not junk, then you're okay in how you are. Did that then kind of shift your path to where you are here today?
Absolutely. So I think that that was a seed that was planted early that said to me that there's a possibility of healing from all of the woundedness. So that the woundedness of not being like the culture of the time that I grew up in, that there's something bigger at work. That idea of being a spiritual being, having a physical experience, became something that I see affirmed over and over and over again in my life experience. Mm-hmm. And we probably, if we all sat down and spent a few minutes just, you know, going deeply within ourselves, we could name in whatever words that we have an experience of what it means to be a spiritual being having a physical experience. We're all on a journey, but we're all on our own journeys in one way. We all go at our own pace. And I think that speaks to a lot of the tension that we feel around us and even in us when we start to compare ourselves to others, or we start to, you know, get into the habit of pigeonholing. And we are products, of course, of being pigeonholed because we don't always feel safe in our environments. And I think that the gift of being queer is that there's an invitation to do deep inner work. You know, a queer friend of mine recently said, you know, what makes us so good at dealing with really hard stuff? And I said, no, what is that? And she said, because we've had a lot of practice. So there's an invitation there to move through those things that are difficult for us. So yeah. I didn't think that I knew another gay person growing up. And I knew that there was no one to ask about my feelings. So I didn't just read the Bible. I also went to the large dictionary in my elementary school library. It was a 9 or 10 year old, you know, trying to figure out what is it that I am? Who am I?
Yeah.
And just, you know, looking up different words and thinking, oh, yeah, that sort of resonates with something that I could identify with if I were being completely honest. Yeah.
I just want to dig into that a little bit. I think for a lot of people, like you said, we're all on our own journeys, and especially with queerness and realizing or coming to almost like a recognition of what you may or may not resonate with. And it sounds like you were saying about like 9 or 10. So it seems like pretty young you realized that traditional form that we're told about didn't resonate with you. And I'd love to understand kind of how you recognized that as a child.
Early on. So I would say that my first experience of an awareness of God's presence was very early for me. And the earliest memory of that is at the age of 4. And there was a certain, there was something that happened in our family at the time. And I named a desire to dig more deeply into my relationship with God to my mother, who said, "You're too young to have this conversation." And that's when we begin, I think, to be split apart from our earliest memories that connect us maybe to our fuller sense of self, is that we begin to hear the voice of mom. She didn't mean anything harmful by that. She was just speaking from her own experience or her own expression. But my reaction to that was to sort of close that piece off to sharing with other people. And I thought, well, maybe I feel this way and I have the sense of, I don't know, being connected to something greater than myself. And I think that's a memory that we all enter the world with, that we forget over time because we're exploring so many ways of being and surviving in the world. But that feeling never left me. And I think as a result of that, and then my curiosity and reading and finding that there is something more to this faith thing than what the institution of that church I grew up in was sharing. I remember at about the same age of 9 or 10, spending lonely summers because I didn't know there was anyone else like me. So I did a lot of reading. I played a lot of music. I'm a musician. And that helped me with, you know, to connect with the world or spend a lot of time outside. But there was just this realization of call and being asked to do something. Well, when someone gives you the idea that you're being invited to do something, what do you say? Tell me more. And the sense that I was being called into this life that I am now serving in as an ordained person in a faith tradition, which happens to be the Episcopal Church. So that seed got planted. As I was coming of age, the AIDS crisis was starting to emerge on the spectrum. So there was another thing I was reading about when our newspaper was delivered every afternoon, and I would secretly take the pages that were talking about this terrible thing, and I was reading the words that were talked about it. So this is an 11, 12, 13-year-old, and realized that they were using words that talked about me, like this was a gay disease. Only gay men got this disease. Well, I was hardly a man, but I could read between the lines. And, you know, even there was an idea put forward in those articles and in reporting at the time that gay people got this disease because they were gay. And it was, you know, before a virus was discovered or any of those things. It's horrifying, and was really horrifying to me as a person that was still developing. And then as I got, you know, out of high school and into college, I did not do well at college, and it took me a while to figure all of that out. I didn't have the family support or the understanding of what it meant to have a desire to go into higher ed. So after a few attempts at college, I realized it wasn't the time for me, and I was living back in my parents' home. As a musician, I was serving as a church musician, so I could use my gifts that way. And so I argued with myself that, see, you're doing what God called you to do, because it's the thing I could do that was accepted, but it wasn't really the thing that I was called to do. Somebody at one point said that I was ahead of my time, and many of us are ahead of our times, and we need to name that and remember that we're still breaking glass ceilings, and that there's still a lot of opposition and resistance and challenge, but that we need also to continue to pave the way forward for others. So I think of the gay men that I knew that were probably my age and older now, as I was, you know, entering into adulthood. My parents asked me to leave their home, and I didn't have a lot of time to think about and process that. So as a 19-year-old, I found myself supporting myself as much as I could and living on my own. And for the grace of God, I could have been homeless in some of that time, but that wasn't what happened. And those were hard years. During that time, I met Brian, who I fell madly in love with and thought we would spend the rest of our lives together, which was my desire, to have a relationship with one person through life. And as it turned out, Brian was HIV positive. Brian died when I was 25. And so that was really, really a watershed moment for me, because I had lived through my parents kicking me out of their home. And I always felt that I did not want to cut my parents off, because that would be proving that the things they said about me were true. I didn't think they were. And so Grace stayed in that relationship. My parents are now in their mid-80s, and I'm still in touch with them. And we have a much better relationship than we did during those hard years. So when Brian died and I realized I would be spending some time in my life alone, I decided that if I could finally put myself through school, that was the next thing that I needed to do. And what is it that I knew that I could do in religious life as a person who was called to serve, and it was to continue to serve in areas of church music. So I have 2 degrees from the Peabody Conservatory of Music in Baltimore in organ performance, which set me up well for a church music career that I knew that I could have and serve in that way. So along those lines, I discovered the Episcopal Church, you know, and I was confirmed in that church, this church, the year that Ryan died, because that was also, I was having a deeply spiritual experience as this thing was happening. And I noticed that even though I was told that, you know, God couldn't exist in a life like mine, God doesn't call people like me, right? All the things that people do to dehumanize us and other us, I just realized that none of that was true.
You are tuned in to WERU Community Radio Station, and you're listening to We Are Queer. I'm your host, Olivia Peruk, and you are listening to a conversation I'm having with Father Douglas Beck on the realization of being called to serve God as a gay man.
When I first discovered the Episcopal Church, I discovered that it already had a statement that it had adopted in 1976. So it would have been like, you know, 18 years, 20 years before I found it. And that was this statement that homosexual persons are children of God who have a full and equal claim with all other persons upon the love, acceptance, and pastoral concern and care of the church. So that was a statement that I recognized as reflecting the very relationship that I was having with the Creator. And here was an opening of a church expression that was on its own slow, painful journey of unfolding to full acceptance and support. Our out acceptance and expressions of ourselves is an expression of the nature of our createdness in the image of God. And so that sets a whole other path for us that takes some courage to walk, because it means that we have to be willing to take our vulnerable selves with us, and we have to acknowledge the pain that we sometimes carry because of the prejudice that we receive. And we can be resolved to do better and to be better in spite of it. When I was in grad school, 1998, I met my now husband, Tom Avila Beck. Tom, I didn't mention this, and I should, because we are in Maine. And my life in Maine began in 1994. I came here in the summertime between semesters and really fell in love with it and thought, I will always come to Maine in the summertime. And also by the time that I had met Tom, I was praying about my future because I was feeling quite ancient at the age of 31. Thinking, what is the rest of my life going to be? My dating life was never great after Brian died. And one of the things that I knew was going to be necessary in a good, healthy relationship was to have a lifelong partner who understood a little bit about my work and didn't mind me getting out of bed early on Sunday morning. And also understood my, you know, my artistic life. And so this person emerged on June 21st. Graduate school, I had one more term in the fall. I went to a baseball game with my best friend, Terry Ray, after doing the services in the morning where I was working, and was just moaning and groaning about what would it take to find someone in life, right? Do you know what that feels like? So my friend, who is my friend to this very day, listened to me very politely. And she said, you know what your problem is, don't you? And I said, yeah, I don't have a partner. And when will this ever happen? She said, well, you've not really put yourself out there, have you? And said, you need to meet people or you're never going to, you know, find an answer to this question. Left that ballgame full of courage. And I went out that evening and thought, you know, my goal tonight is to meet a lot of people. And one of those people was this person who was visiting Baltimore, who was living in Philadelphia at the time. It was Tom. Three things I learned about Tom. Tom grew up in Maine. Tom has an undergraduate degree in art, and Tom's grandfather was a minister. Here was somebody who was fully equipped to move beyond the first stages of falling madly in love with one another to deepen into a full life. So we've been together for 26 years.
Oh,
uh-huh.
Wow. I know. That's really special.
It is extremely special. And so we don't take for granted the special things in our lives, even or especially when life is hard, we're reminded of the good things that we have. So from there, we lived in Washington, D.C. for 12 years, and we're coming to Maine in the summer, and at that time, Christmas too, because we were coming home to family at Christmas time. And we lived as married people do because we didn't have anything else, right? And when marriage became a reality, or it looked like it might happen, there were two pieces of that puzzle that were important to us. One was that, of course, it'd be possible to be married in church. And the other is that it'd be legally possible for us to get married. So we got married on the marriage became possible in the state of Maine by referendum in November of 2012. The church at that point had affirmed, already acknowledged and affirmed same-sex couples in the life of the church. That happened in 2009. In 2012, the church called for the repeal of discriminatory federal laws for same-sex domestic partners and recommended a liturgy of blessing of relationships. And later in 2012, the laws, the canons of the Episcopal Church were amended to prohibit discrimination. In this diocese in 2013, it was already possible to be married in church. So we were married on June 22nd, 2013. It was 15 years and one day after we met in Baltimore. And all of that happened for us. And then 2 years later, the Supreme Court ruled that same-sex couples had the legal right to marry. So our marriage was recognized by the state and then recognized nationally in 2015.
Obviously, being a younger queer person, within my lifetime, that was the amendment. So although I was much younger and wasn't ever thinking of marriage or things, I think, you know, it's a good reminder for young queer people, just what our elders and people of older generations went through, that you could have had a love of your life who was the same sex partner, but not be recognized.
That was always a fear for us. One of the big losses in our family life is not having children. And this is something that we both longed for. And I also recognized that a certain biology being what it is, I felt that I'm 3.5 years older than Tom. So I was especially sensitive to, you know, timing out as a parent, right? At what age do you realize that adopting an infant and raising an infant is going to be really challenging, as, you know, because of the aging process? And that was a really hard threshold for us to pass. But also, since then, we've recognized that our lives have developed a certain sense of fullness and expression that they were meant to. I never would have been able to go back to school, you know, when I was able to do that, to go to seminary and take the time to commit to that work. And so for us, that the fulfillment of my call, that Tom has been a rock for the whole time. You know, in 2009, we were cooking dinner together in Washington, D.C. in our kitchen. And I said, you know, I think it's time for me to say out loud over and over and over again that God has called me to be a priest. And surprisingly to me, Tom looked at me and said, what took you so long? And then said, you know, others have seen this in you for a very long time, and it is time. And the church was catching up for us at that time. So even though that 1976 statement about affirming that homosexual persons are children of God, etc., it was the beginning of a process that's still unfolding. There are still parts of our church that aren't there, but we can't wait. No, we have to be who we are as in the fullness of our being now. I remember in the late 90s being incredibly frustrated with the church because I thought, if I am good enough to serve as a lay person, and if my relationship with Tom is as deep as a marriage, why are we not good enough to live out lives? So I needed my expression of myself means that I am out, and I couldn't hide that in order to go through a church office or process for ordination. So there was work to be done there, and that work has been paved. In 2003, the Right Reverend Gene Robinson was elected as the first openly gay married man clergy to be bishop in the world in the Anglican Communion. And that set up another process of challenge, but also good progress. So a lot has changed for us in the world, and also opportunities in the Episcopal Church, at least, to be a spiritual person of deep faith and to live in community with others, which is what the church is, of what we hold in common. Mm-hmm. What we hold in common is our belovedness as, you know, people that reflect the image of God.
Just winding down here, I'm wondering if you said that although there's been a lot of progress, there still could be some more. Could you maybe speak a little bit to what you mean by that?
Well, absolutely. I think we serve in all the ways that we can, where we can, as a witness to those places that are still closed. I couldn't serve as a rector in any Episcopal church because there's still Episcopal churches that would not have an openly gay married to a man person in their leadership. The history of this church, interestingly, is the timeline. It outlines the timeline of what we've just talked about. So the first Episcopal church service that happened in somebody's house, and it was on June 15th, 1975, right as the church was wrestling with these issues. That statement from 1976 didn't come out of the blue. They had been talking about this for a long time. And as the Episcopal church presence in Blue Hill and this area unfolded, some of our founding members were queer, partnered, unpartnered, but from the very founding. And when the AIDS crisis began from the start, there was a ministry here to serve that need in the community before we knew fully what this thing was. Here in Blue Hill, something was happening. When I met with the discernment committee to interview for the position I hold, I shared with them how I felt driving by this church, as I had for years living in Maine, and I noticed the addition on our sign by the road of the rainbow flag as a witness and fuller expression of invitation to everybody who is welcome to be here, regardless of their orientation or family history or background or anything. So I'm so grateful to have a place like this where I can serve openly and welcome others and some who I can share, you know, in life with because we have things in common. It's exciting. To be held in love by everybody in this community means the world. I hope that when we share stories of our lives, that they encourage others who have the same struggles that we have, that we're living in this time of new beginnings and we can rise above our challenges to meet those needs. Like my family, my friend, who is a family friend, said to me the other month, we are equipped to do the work that we do because of the challenges that we've faced, that we know how to live intentions and thrive and to encourage expressions of love and care for one another, even in the face of having experiences from some who have not given us that, we can rise and be better in spite of all of it.
Thank you to today's guest, Father Douglas Beck, who reminded us that we are not junk and to continue to believe in love. Thank you also to Juniper Ginger, a local artist in Maine who created our theme. And that is all for We Are Queer. My name is Olivia Peruk, and we will be back next month. If you have feedback for the show or want to get in touch, email info@weru.org with WERQ in the subject line. Thank you for being with us, and remember to stay curious and kind. Stay tuned for more public affairs broadcasting.